Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
What feels to me very strong racist ideology against Palestinians.
Right.
Your life is chosen, decided for you by the military occupation.
Why are the political elites, the so-called liberal elites of the world, why are they so silent?
It's unbearable what they've done. And to have done it with the full-blooded assent of the leadership of most of Europe, Britain and the United States has brought the West into great disrepute. By not speaking out, you're helping to enable them.
As the unrelenting Gaza killing of civilians continues unabated, another potential ethnic cleansing in Palestine is underway, again in plain sight. The gradual conquest of Palestinian land is continuing at pace. Armed Israeli settlers, with the full backing of the state, pillage and forcibly vacate entire villages and farming communities. Yet the international community remains mute. This is ethnic cleansing on two fronts. Today I have back on The Thinking Muslim journalist, author and public commentator Peter Oborne, who has returned recently from a visit to the West Bank. Peter is almost unique in the mainstream media for being someone who has consistently called out the marginalization of the Muslim community, both here and abroad. Peter principally writes for the Middle East Eye, amongst other outlets. His books include The Fate of Abraham, Why the West is Wrong About Islam, and The Assault on Truth. Peter Oborne, welcome to The Thinking Muslim.
It's a great pleasure to come back.
Thank you for being here. Now, you've just returned from a two-week journey to the West Bank. I read a very disturbing piece you wrote that indicates settlers have increased their land grab. Please talk me through what you witnessed when you were there.
Actually, I think it was probably 5 weeks in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and I got back about 10 days ago. It's quite harrowing. To travel around the West Bank at the moment, because literally every village I went to is under attack from settlers. They all have roughly the same story, which is that the settlers will come in often with machine guns. They will beat up farmers, any male. They can attack women too. The children are traumatized by seeing their fathers or uncles beaten up. They use the guns normally. You know, they might spray the water system. They go into houses, sort of rip, you know, just tear them apart, steal money, and in certain the smaller communities in around Mustafa Yatta in the south, around the Hebron Hills, beautiful part of the world, breathtaking. they're much more vulnerable because they're surrounded by settlements and there may be just 200, 150 people living there. And they come in and they're driving out the herdsmen or the farmers. Some of these are very ancient. Well, they're all ancient communities. Some of the Bedouin, you know, these are war crimes, actually, because it's occupied territory and you're invariably the IDF will protect the, come in with the settlers or protect them if need be. So it's supported by the Israeli military and they're driving the Palestinians off their land and away from their ancient homes.
Tell me about the IDF's role in protecting these settlers as they ransack these villages.
Yeah, it's quite complicated. And I've seen them with settlers, but the accounts I've got is that settlers might come in and if the villagers resist, not with stones or something, the IDF will turn up and help. Or sometimes they will come in together with the IDF. Often it's hard to know because the settlers often wear military fatigues and carry guns. Some really harrowing videos I've been shown. I'm sure you've seen some of them. I think the IDF has a double role. It will protect the settlers and certainly it won't stop them doing these illegal things. Yeah. But again, I think they're also there to restrain, probably on orders from the above, to restrain the settlers. They don't want a mass atrocity.
Right.
And so if you look at the number of deaths inflicted on Palestinians in the West Bank since October the 7th, it's well over 200 now, but very small number, I think maybe a dozen have been people killed by settlers. And I think that that's... A surprisingly small number, and I suspect there's some restraint from the army on the settlers.
And who are these settlers? Where do they come from? Do they come from within Israel proper or from outside?
Well, they all live in the occupied West Bank in these settlements. There are two types of settlement. There are the so-called legal settlements, i.e. recognized by the State of Israel.
Right.
And then there are illegal settlements, which are not recognized by the State of Israel, but they sort of are as well, you know. I mean, these are where, so around Nablus, where I spent a lot of time, you get the so-called hilltop youth, which are very unpleasant, not indeed, very dangerous, filled with the kind of radical settler ideas, which... based around obscure but deadly sort of eschatological theses about, you know, the land of Israel belonging, or Eretz Israel between the river and the sea, belonging to the Jews. And the Palestinians really don't have a role there at all.
You, in your article, there was some mention of a village where 250 members of that village, the residents of that village, had to vacate because of persecution from these settlers. There is, of course, tacit, if not overt, approval from the security forces, but also you mentioned the role of Ben Gvir, the national security minister. Explain his particularly insidious role in this.
The settlers have been particularly vicious since October the 7th. They've been driven by revenge. They've been driven, I think, licensed in some ways, just to sort of rampage.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you've got to, if you look at the history of this problem, it goes back finally to 1967, the Six-Day War, when Israel seized control of the West Bank from, it was up to that point, it belonged to Jordan and also the Golan Heights and Gaza from Egypt. Now, gradually after that, the settler movement developed, often without the support of the state, but always with some kind of conversation with the state. And in the last 20 years, a radical settler, very radical settler movement has, with a sort of basically a supremacist ideology, land belongs to us, has developed. Now, they had two, that settler movement has two principal leaders, there are others. Ben-Gavir, who is head of the so-called, well, it translates as Jewish Power, and
this is a right-wing party.
Well, I'd say a right-wing doesn't quite, you know, cover it. You know, it's full of what I would say, what feels to me, very strong racist ideology against Palestinians.
Right.
That's the way it looks to me. I mean, Mr. Ben-Gavir is one of those, until recently, would have been a very fringe figure.
Mm.
Probably he'd be arrested in Britain, I think. Mm. I just don't think he could operate. But anyway, there he was a fringe figure, and suddenly he became mainstream, even though for a long time he had in his, I think it's his house or his office, one of the two, he had a picture of that Baruch Goldstein.
Yeah.
He was a settler living in Kiryat Arba, which is just above Hebron.
Mm.
And he's the man who went in, it's terrible, into the Tomb of the Patriarchs with a machine gun and killed 29 worshippers. And is now, I went up to Kiryat Arba I was told he was buried there, so I went up there to have a look, and it was a shrine.
Mm.
It's quite interesting.
Really?
I mean, it's terrifying. It's chilling. Yeah. And Ben-Gavir had a picture of this monster. And so that tells you a lot about who he is.
Yeah.
And he is, incredibly, Netanyahu appointed him national security minister.
Yeah.
He's been since October the 7th, he's been distributing guns, encouraging. I think I'm right in saying he's encouraging the use of militias effectively.
Right.
This is really dangerous stuff. That's fascism, actually. They encourage distribute guns to your supporters.
Yeah. And Smotrich, he's also part of Netanyahu's coalition. Tell me a little bit more about.
Yeah.
Bezalel
Smotrich,
yeah.
who runs something called the Religious Zionist Party,
mm.
And really it's quite hard, without being an expert, to tell the difference between these two parties, which essentially maintain that not just 1948 Israel, but the West Bank. Is Israeli or is Jewish. And Smotrich was a marginal figure, but in order to stay in power, Mr. Netanyahu himself, that's probably the most right-wing, far-right prime minister Israel has had, went into an agreement with the leader, with Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, of these two settler parties, effectively, and having made Ben-Gavir national security minister, he then made Smotrich the equivalent of the Chancellor of the Exchequer,
right,
finance minister. But also, Smotrich held out for the role of running the civil administration of the West Bank.
Really,
now that sounds. Sounds rather a sort of unthreatening term, civil administration, but it's Orwellian term.
Yeah.
So you have to remember, and I'm now using the language of every human rights group in the world, including the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. I'm sure there are some human rights groups which don't, but Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, others say that this is an apartheid regime.
Right.
And on the West Bank, it's glaring. You have, if you're Palestinian, you don't get the vote in Israel. You haven't had for since 1967. On the other hand, you are subject to the control of a military regime. You're under occupation.
Yeah.
And in the largest area of the West Bank, so-called Area C, which isn't really, you think of the rural parts of the West Bank.
Mm.
And they determine whether or not you can build a house, and they'll pull it down if you don't. what roads you can use, what travel you have, etc. It's your life is chosen, decided for you by the military occupation, and that's the, but so whether or not you can build your house or the road you can use or whatever, it's part of the civil administration.
Yeah,
and that's what I mean by Orwellian. It's really the it's the civilian side of the military operation.
You met with, I suppose, ordinary Palestinians who live in the West Bank, who live in Section C of the West Bank. What impression did you get from them about how they are living their lives on a daily basis?
Well, it's really, I spent a certain amount of time in the south. As I say, these villages, which are so threatened.
Yeah.
And the people, every few days, the settlers would come into their village, beat them up, burn their car, bulldoze their agricultural buildings, etc.
Yeah.
Tell them to get out, you know, and it's terrifying. I mean, it's intimidation. And they all said that if they rang up the police, Israeli police, they're told nothing to do with us.
Yeah.
So they're defenseless. And it was harrowing talking to them. You know, I arrived at one of the villages and the child shrank from me.
Right.
Amazed.
Why?
Because I think he was used to seeing these monstrous men turning up from the neighboring settlements and beating up his father or something. I mean, it's literally grotesque. These are very vulnerable communities. Where I spent more time, which was in the villages around Nablus or Ramallah in the north of the West Bank, the villages would tend to be larger, and you can see that the settlers haven't got the wherewithal at this stage anyway to drive out a village of 3,000 people.
Right.
What they've done, been doing is going. They go in through the village of iron bars and guns, and they might attack a house or two, particularly outlying houses, burn them or try to burn them down. But what was most horrifying at this, one of the horrifying things was they will stop farmers going to their land. This is the olive harvesting season, which since time immemorial is a lovely part, a magical part of the whole season, the whole year, and they're being stopped from getting to their olives, and the settlers will either burn down the olive trees or they might pick them themselves, or very wickedly they'll just wait till the end of the day when the Palestinians have picked their olives and steal them off them. It's disgusting.
Right.
And there's no defense. The Palestinian does try to stand up for himself, he's likely to be hauled away as a terrorist and see it's all at the court. I mean, it is grotesque. Also, notice, I don't know if she's improved, the British Consul General, Diana Corner, she used to issue statements condemning particularly grotesque settler behaviour, supposing they, or IDF behaviour, they shot dead a child, which they often do. But she stopped doing that when I last looked. I ought to check again, actually. Why?
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrible. I mean, and I think this does raise the question of British complicity in all of this.
Right.
Just forget about the wickedness of the Israeli state.
Yeah.
Just think about the way in which the international community has enabled this by effectively allowing Israel and the settlers to act with total impunity towards vulnerable people.
So you've used the word apartheid, another word that's been associated not only with Gaza, which we'll come to, but also the West Bank, is a slow, gradual ethnic cleansing. Would you go as far as to say that is the ultimate plan of the Netanyahu government?
Okay, it's quite a difficult question. Looking at the West Bank, if you look at the what they're actually doing, according to Bat Salem, the Israeli human rights organization, when I last looked, 16 communities have been no longer exist.
Yeah,
which existed on the 7th of October. Mm. About 1,000 people are involved. They're small communities, these, but you know, it's these are people who've just lost. That is war. Those are war crimes. It's state approved, state sanctioned, state sponsored. I think fair to say, violence leading to people being driven off their land. I call that. I think that is a war crime, and there's no. It should be prosecuted, and the, it should be called out as a war crime. And the failure of America and Britain.
Yeah.
To do this, and also to point the finger at Israel and say, you, Netanyahu, you, Smotrich, you, Ben-Gavir, the Israeli government are doing this. I find it completely baffling.
Well, let's turn to Gaza, because, of course, it's horrific what we see on our TV screens and on our social media feeds on a daily basis. I mean, it's been an appalling 2 months nearly of violence, and a large number of Gazans have died. And you've intimated there that there isn't a total silence or a very casual relationship between the United States, Britain, the European Union and Israel. What's going on there? Why are the political elites, the so-called liberal elites of the world, why are they so silent at what is so obviously an appalling abuse of human rights?
Yeah, it's I don't know whether to use the word genocide. I'm not an expert on the term, but you're seeing mass transfer of civilians. Yeah. You're seeing the slaughter of innocent civilians on a huge scale.
Yeah.
The destruction of civilian infrastructure, the destruction of hospitals, schools, the targeting of groups like journalists. It's pretty obvious that they're doing that.
Yeah.
And he's sticking, first of all, with Britain. The fact that the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is happy to say that he's giving Israel his unequivocal support.
Yeah.
And then they say that they support... and then they say, you know, that Israel is abiding by international law. They even kind of cut, some ministers have said this. It's not true.
Yes.
And even more surprising, given that he comes from a progressive political party with a record of standing up for minorities and human rights, I find Keir Starmer's conduct extraordinary, particularly since he's explicitly said very early on that it's that collective punishment in the form of sort of withholding water and food was Israel. It was entitled to do that, and so we have both the main political parties in this country supporting, really strongly supporting the activities of the Israeli state, the Israeli army in Gaza. It takes a lot to stomach this. I mean, it's this in a country which claims to want care about human rights and democracy and so forth.
Yeah. I want to turn to the position of Keir Starmer, because I think it's particularly egregious, in particular because so many Muslims, I think I remember reading that in 2019, the intention of most Muslim voters, 71% of Muslim voters voted for the Labour Party. So it's always been the home of Muslim votes. But also, we know that Keir Starmer comes from a very strong human rights background. And so he knows about international law, and he's aware of the various statutes and conventions that guide international law. Why has Keir Starmer so stubbornly stuck to this position that sounds like it's advocating, if not greenlighting, the Israeli state?
Yeah, you actually have to ask him. But unfortunately, he has a record of being dishonest and giving misleading answers to questions.
Yeah,
I keep a record of political lies.
Yes, you wrote a book on it.
Yes,
starting with Tony Blair, I think.
Yeah, Tony Blair. Let's just say we have to speculate.
Okay.
Rather than I can't without. Looking inside Mr. Starmer's or Sir Keir's brain. And so I think part of it is the Corbyn business, you know, the anti-Semitism charges laid against Jeremy Corbyn,
right,
which Mr. Corbyn greatly denies, and I think his rebuttals are convincing.
Right.
I don't think he's an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
But that this dominated the kind of, it was a huge press witch hunt. And Starmer decided, after becoming leader, to define himself as leader, as the man who has stamped out Labour anti-Semitism. Now, given that he was a supporter and, in his own words, a friend of Corbyn, while Corbyn was leader, this is a very retrospective thing to do.
Right.
And given, I'm sure you've read the Martin Ford report, which is a major corrective to the press hysteria. If anybody hasn't read it, they should. And it's quite damning, I think, by implication at any rate, of Sir Keir Starmer's conduct, because it seems deeply unfair and wrong. But the fact is that he, having chosen to define himself by not being Corbyn, I think he, and then this all happened, I think that he felt that he had to, his reaction to the bombing may have been shaped. I'm saying this is only speculation.
Yes.
May have been shaped by the his urgent desire to distance himself from Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
And the second factor, which may be equally important or more important, is Sir Keir Starmer is, I think he values his relationship with the United States.
Right.
All British anybody wanting to be British Prime Minister tends to do that.
Yeah.
And certainly his unlamented predecessor, Tony Blair, did. I mean, but this is, for some reason, we do have a special relationship. It's not a relationship of equals.
Yeah.
I mean, you know perfectly well, if Biden had called for a ceasefire 5 weeks ago, Starmer and Sunak would have jumped to attention and done the same.
Yes.
At once.
Yeah.
They take their lead from the United States. I think it's wrong, I think, because Biden has been a mess. It does enormous discredit to the Western world, this blind support for Israel. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't condemn the atrocities committed by Hamas on the 7th of October. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't want war crimes investigations into what Hamas did. But you should also demand war crimes investigations into what's happened since with the Israelis. And they've killed, 16,000, probably substantially more, more than 20,000 people, including, I mean, it's unbearable what they've done. And to have done it with the full-blooded assent of the leadership of most of Europe, Britain, and the United States has brought the West into great disrepute.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Peter, you care a lot about the rule of law and about justice. And I know from previous discussions with you that you believe there are very strong institutions in these countries that uphold these very valued, let's call them liberal democratic values. But then there is a question about how the worthiness or the efficacy of these values or how they're presented now to the rest of the world. I interviewed the former head of Al Jazeera, Wadar Khanfer, a couple
very
of weeks
good man,
back.
Yeah.
Excellent. And he argued that Gaza symbolized something greater. It's almost like the graveyard for liberal values. Like Western values are now no longer going to be supported or seen by those in the East or those in the South as values that are worth upholding for them. I mean, do you think that this is going to, the whole Gaza episode has irreversibly, you can say, damaged the West and its value system?
I've been following Western foreign policy now for a long time.
Mm.
And so none of this is a surprise.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you think, go back to the Iraq invasion in 2003, that was an illegal invasion.
Yeah.
Based on fabricated information.
Yeah.
And it's very easy, it's very convincing to make an argument that the United States and Britain have been rogue states, to use terminology used against people like Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, etc.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, it was very moving being in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. People would say to you, I used to look to the West. I thought that they were on our side. They would bring us some justice. And now that's just gone.
Right.
And that's what Palestinians who really did believe and love, in, I think, the West in many ways, now feel that can't be the case anymore. Mm. One thing is obvious. If you're looking towards a conclusion of all of this, America is wholly unfit to have any role in the future. I'm not saying it won't have a role. It's just unfit to have a role. It's completely biased. It's been held up as a mediator for peace for ages, and it's played it, in Camp David and so on. And it's not a fair player. It's on the other side. It's always of the Israelis.
Mm.
Cannot be trusted by any Palestinian.
Well, what's your perspective on the position of Ursula von der Leyen from the European Union Commission, the president of the Commission, who again was her position was, probably even more firm than the Biden position. And she, came across as very pro-Israel. Now, the European Union has historically, at least, been a great funder of people of Gaza and has taken a slightly more nuanced position towards Palestine. Why do you think such illustrious liberal institutions like the European Union have so succumbed to the Israeli narrative?
I don't understand it, actually.
Yeah.
You've got to look at the way... I think Germany, for very obvious reasons, the Holocaust is overcome with national guilt.
Right.
And that's easy to understand.
They banned demonstrations in Germany for pro-Palestinian demonstrations, it seems.
They shouldn't do, though. They are overcome. It is some... In the case of Britain, something has changed. There used to be quite a fair-minded or even-handed discourse about Israel, Palestine, in the Conservative Party, partly shaped by... There may have been an element of anti-Semitism. Mm. No question there was anti-Semitism in the Conservative Party, and probably still is, actually, but there was.
Yeah.
But there was also the experience of... Jewish terrorism, as it was seen by the British at the time before independence in 1948, 48 was aimed, you know, against British targets.
Yeah.
King David, you know, the explosion of the King David Hotel, campaign of assassination, attacks on, horrible attacks on British soldiers in the Mandate, Palestine and so on.
Yeah.
Aimed at driving the British out. But also, I think, there was just a general fair-mindedness. Mm. So I think I'm right in saying in 1973 war, for instance, the British had an embargo on arms to either side. Mm. Thatcher, who was very philo-Semitic and very pro-Israel, but he was always happy to condemn or ready to condemn Israeli atrocities, Shatila and Sabra camp, the Israeli abetted massacre of Palestinian refugees. She called it pure barbarism. Mm. And I don't understand why the new generation, or rather the new generation of Tories, can't do that. They seem unable to find that language, which Thatcher had. And I do point this out to them. And I think there are two reasons. One actually is the amazing ignorance of how the world works, or recent history of the Middle East. And I think one has been the terrific success of the Israeli lobby in Parliament, in particular the Conservative Friends of Israel. Very perfectly honourable objective, by the way, to put the Israeli point of view. But they have had it. I think they've been a bit too successful in a way for their own good, because if I think a real friend of Israel would criticize Israel if I was them. I mean, I asked them, have you ever criticized Israel for anything? No. You know, not Sabra and Shatila, not, the horrific attack on Lebanon in 2006, they haven't. Not the basic, the new basic law, not sort of creeping, no settlement. No, they've not criticised anything.
Yes.
And I think this is, they've convincingly made the case to the many Conservative MPs, the great majority it seems, that Israel is, you know, plucky little Israel surrounded by enemies, the one shining beacon of democracy and human rights in the Middle East.
Yeah.
They're entitled to make that case, but it has meant that Israeli leaders have a sense of impunity. They've been given it, never forget, and a very good example of this, terrible example actually, was Boris Johnson, when he was Prime Minister, two years ago, wrote a letter to the Conservative Friends of Israel, saying, look, Britain would not support any war crimes investigations into Israel's conduct. Well, you're saying just carry on killing that, really, aren't you? And so I think that they, a candid friend of Israel, which Britain, say Maggie Thatcher was prepared to be, would say if you step beyond a certain line, you say, look, you call them out, no, and that's going to be investigated, and the perpetrators will find themselves at The Hague and so on. That would be the proper way of dealing with it, and it might have helped Israel evolve in a different way.
Can I return back to the Labour Party, and in particular the position of many of the Muslims who are representatives in the Labour Party? I think something that a lot of the Muslim community have been quite disturbed by is just how many of those Muslim representatives have been ready to toe the line. I mean, Shabana Mahmood comes to mind. She's the MP for Birmingham Ladywood, policy director of the Starmer campaign in 24. Again, you know, very silent over Gaza, even though historically she has had a pretty good record on Palestine. There is this growing feeling that the Labour Party structurally is really not going to stand up for causes that Muslims feel strongly about, in particular international causes. What accounts for the inability of these representatives? I mean, Ladywood is ranked in the top five of Muslim concentrated constituencies in the country. What accounts for their complicity, I suppose, is the word when it comes to such horrendous crimes?
I agree with the term complicity, because by not speaking out, you're helping to enable them.
Yeah.
You're making it easier for Israel to commit them.
Yeah.
Without being held to account. Yeah. And as the, you know, everyone thinks Starmer's going to be the next prime minister. And so the next British prime minister, whereas Sunak is seen as increasingly as some form of great mistake. And so Starmer's got a lot of power, even though he's not in power.
Yeah.
And so were he to have reacted in a different way, as Jeremy Corbyn would have done, not Tony Blair. I think Tony Blair would never criticise, if I'm right, criticise Israel.
Yeah.
But earlier Labour leaders, for sure.
Yeah.
I think, again, I talked a little bit earlier on about the legacy of the Corbyn years and the charges laid against Corbyn and the way that Starmer has sought to shape himself, to define himself against Starmer. And he has got an authoritarian leadership style. He's talked to build himself up as a sort of man who can't be challenged. Mm. So it's partly that. But it's morally, many people think this is morally disgusting.
Yeah.
And I think you can draw comparisons with Labour in 2005, can't you, when Tony Blair going to war against Iraq offended many Muslims in Britain.
Yeah.
They've almost been a Labour bloc, haven't they?
Absolutely. I think the largest bloc probably Labour have from any ethnic community.
Yeah.
Then that leads me to what I sense on the ground, and I could be wrong, I've got a partial sense, but the feeling I get from the Muslim community, and that was backed up by a census, a survey recently by the Muslim Census Group, which indicated that if an election took place tomorrow, only 5% of the Muslim community would vote Labour. And that was from a 30,000 sample in their survey. I yesterday was at a meeting in Ilford North, West Streeting's constituency. He's got a 5,000 majority. And there is a strong groundswell of opinion there that we need to stand against West Streeting, who's, of course, a shadow health secretary and is sort of a leading light within the Labour Party. The impression I get is they want to put forward an independent to fight him using the Muslim and the wider community vote. I suppose I've got two questions there. Firstly, is that a wise thing for the Muslim community to do in the sense that would it lead to greater, I don't know, marginalization of the Muslim community? And do you see that strategy of putting forward independence ultimately successful in a system like ours?
To answer your first question, I think the Labour Party has made the decision, Starmer's Labour Party, to marginalize British Muslims. There's quite a lot of evidence of very bad Islamophobia inside Starmer's Labour Party. The Labour Files programmes
produced Al Jazeera.
Some of it was quite shocking about the way that Labour was behaving towards its Muslim voters and Muslim officers as well.
Yeah.
I really recommend people should see that.
Yeah.
And on that, and following, you know, the reaction to Labour's morally negligent reaction to Israeli conduct in Gaza and the West Bank, I think that Muslims are entitled to ask, you know, we feel that they've, by the way, this is not simply a Muslim issue. It's actually a basic human issue of human rights and decent conduct. But in the light of Labour's tolerance of Islamophobia, which we need to discuss more at a certain stage, on an epic scale, plus its foreign policy issues, I think that you Muslims are... they can't vote Tory because Tories are worse, I'd say. I mean, the Islamophobia inside the Conservative Party is rampant.
Yes.
It's a racist party, the Conservatives, now.
Sayed Abarsi has effectively said so, right?
Yeah. I mean, and, of course, the police. So you can't... And why not? I think in many ways Muslims would find themselves aligned with many ordinary non-Muslim voters. I mean, if you look at the figures about the war, I think it's something like 3/4 of voters would like a ceasefire. And neither of the two main parties are able to support that position. I think what you have here is not so much marginalization of Muslim voters. You have an abyss dividing the political media class. I mean, the media, mass media, is part of the problem too.
Yeah.
From ordinary voters in this country, and so I don't simply see it. Something's gone wrong with our politics, and also the morality at the top of our politics.
Can I finish with? A question about the Conservative Party. Now, I remember back to our interview last year, you see yourself as a traditional Conservative. And in so many ways, traditional Conservatives like yourself or Ken Clark have been sort of forced out of the party. I know you're not a card-carrying member, but forced out of that broad church that was the Conservative Party that brought together traditional One Nation, as well as more right-leaning conservatives. It seems to me that after the next general election, the party will lurch even further to the right, maybe with a Kemi Badenoch or even a Suella Braverman leadership. Do you feel that conservatives like you no longer have a home in the Conservative Party for the near future, or even further future?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this quite hard.
Yeah.
And actually, the events of the last week have really clarified this issue. So you are now having a battle for the leadership of the heart of the Conservative Party going on in office, but really with an eye, I think, to when after the next election has been lost. And on the one hand, we have... Suella Braverman. Migration is the great issue, which has been identified by the far right.
Right.
And Suella Braverman is clearly putting herself forward as the leader of this. She got a very important new ally in Jenrick, Robert Jenrick.
Who resigned,
the immigration minister who resigned. So you're going to have... there's talk of a bid to unseat Rishi Sunak. I don't think that will happen.
No.
But after an election defeat, that is going to be a huge battle.
Yeah.
And if the Braverman tendency wins, I think the Conservative Party will actually cease to be. Well, it will be able to keep the name Conservative, which is very important because it legitimizes. But its nature will be like the National Front, Front National in France.
As bad as that.
Yeah, yeah, or AfD in Germany, or it'll be a far-right party. Very frightening. It will be proto-fascist.
Yeah.
Without not every element of fascism. The fascism encouraged the street violence. But Braverman came quite close to doing that. Was playing with that anyway, with her disgraceful remarks about the marches a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, actually, one very final question. Last year, I asked you a very similar question about Muslims here, especially young Muslims who have decided that maybe Britain is just not their long-term home. And there is a movement of British Muslims moving abroad, sometimes to other Muslim countries like Turkey, maybe even Eastern countries beyond Turkey, that may not be Muslim countries, but just moving away because of the hostile environment they find themselves in. I've noticed in the last 2 months over Gaza, that feeling has intensified because not only is the environment hostile, but also the political class is obviously not responding to what they see to be an obvious sentiment that everyone should believe in. We're against genocide and against such mass slaughter. I suppose what I want is your comment on that. I mean, how I see that is very likely. I think over the next decade, you will see a migration away from the West of young Muslims. I mean, this is turning out to be a very long question, but I spoke to a group of young university students recently. You know, these are people who are at LSE and King's, and almost every single one of them said that after they graduate, they're trying to find a route to leave the country. So I think it's a very unexplored phenomenon. But I would like your comments on that, Peter.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's very distressing.
Mm.
I mean, I haven't heard that.
Yeah.
I mean, not. I think in the way you've described it. Secondly, of course, Douglas Murray and that tendency would love to hear this.
Absolutely.
So it is an objective to depopulate Britain of many of its Muslims.
Yeah.
If you just read the rhetoric of people like Murray.
Yeah.
It makes sense because, Saeed Avasti in her excellent book calls it The Enemy Within.
Yeah.
And that has got worse, that deliberate framing of the Britain's Muslim majority Britain's Muslim minority as terroristic or a potential enemy has got worse. And for evidence, actually I'm working on this, trying to find more examples, but just people just by expressing children in schools who just express support for Palestine find themselves called in by the thought police, the prevent officers. Yeah. Now this is horrible. I mean, the idea that opposing the same British government which supports the slaughter in Gaza is at the same time targeting people who oppose, who are calling for a ceasefire, is and the British media shares a lot of that. It supports Israel and Gaza, but it portrays people who went on the marches as hate marches. They've got their priorities all wrong. It's worth saying it's not just a problem for Muslims. It's a problem for a lot of the most ordinary, decent British people. There is a twisted value structure being imposed on us by this far right. And we have a far right conservative government at the moment, not alone what shape or form conservatives may take after an election defeat. We have a fight for liberal democracy on our hands at the moment. And I would, I'd ask your friends you were talking to reconsider, simply because I want to join them in their fight for British values, because that's what they want. That's what they're fighting for, is British values against a government which is increasingly anti-British, in the sense that Britain has always stood up for embraced minorities, whether they're ethnic groups or religious groups. I mean, we've had this long, wonderful battle to include people in our society, and to suddenly start excluding them.
Yeah. Peter Oban, it's been wonderful, as always, speaking to you. Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you. It's a very serious conversation.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels, and head over to our website, thinkinmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.